Okay. So yesterday we started looking at the answers of different Rishonim as to why, if in theory the rabbis have the power based on their authority of uprooting the Torah to fun sugya in and of itself, but if they have the ability to tell you don't perform a mitzvah, because we're worried that in the performance of a mitzvah or in pursuit of the performance of a mitzvah or something like that, you'll violate an iser, so why do they... why do they implement this mechanism only in limited circumstances? And the classic case that Rishonim bring to contrast shofar and lulav is mila, right? So we started with the Ritva, and for the Ritva, it sounds like according to the Ritva, the rabbis don't want to, or they perceive themselves as not having the authority to do a frontal assault on something that's definitely a Torah mitzvah. But if there's some sort of doubt involved, so then that already gives them their in. So shofar and lulav, which depend on the calendar, so at least they are instituted in a way that it's related to some sort of doubt. But when it comes to mila, which is not calendar based, but is obviously is days based, so that's not the case. That was the Ritva. Then we saw Tosfot, and Tosfot gave two answers. Now, if you remember, I laid out what I think is a helpful sort of three axes to think of in terms of rabbinic legislation, that there are three reasons why rabbis might choose not to set up a degree, because these are the three factors the rabbis care about, right? One is, how likely is it that the Torah law will be violated? The second is, how bad would it be if the law in question was violated? And the third is, what is the cost to people's lives or to the halachic system to set up such a decree? So Tosfos, his first answer was on which axis? Cost, right? Because Tosfos said, look, by Mila, there is a concern that you might violate Shabbos to carry the baby, the knife, the whatever. But Mila is really, really, really important because there are 13 expressions of covenant associated with Brit, as its name indicates, and therefore it's not worth the cost to the halachic system to prohibit it. So, yes, logically, it makes sense to prohibit it, but we're not going to. Yeah?
If you were to miss a Brit Mila, you do it the next day?
Yes. Okay. Yes. But Mila Bizmana is the main mitzvah. Right, Mila Bizmana is the mitzvah, right? Bayom Hashmini, Yimol Bisar Lato, right? It's not like a lechatchila, right? That is the day, and anything else is you missed it, so the guy still needs to be Nimol, right? But it's not. But obviously, the eighth day is when you're supposed to have a bris. That's what the pasuk says. So that was the first answer of Tosfos. The second answer of Tosfos was on the concern axis. Right, which was, Mila is normally done by professionals, and professionals are less likely to mess up or need training or whatever the case may be to end up in a situation of Shabbat violation as opposed to shofar or lulav, which is in the hands of the laity. Right? That was the second answer in Tosfos. Okay, so we go back to this last source and get a few, you know, we don't have to go through all of it, but let's look at a few of the other positions, because as I said, there are many suggestions given in the Rishonim, and we'll just try to sort of frame them place them in the framework we set up, and then we'll see the Taz. Okay? So, the top of the second column here. Who wants to take third possibility? Gavi. I know you're dying to.
Which one you said?
On the second column, the top second line, Inami.
By Mila, we don't use Zerakrava at all. The Pahu Trebo of Malacha is a Hainu Pah. Because we permit doing the of Malacha of Chobel, the Chabon the EF Sharon Mitzvah below the Theatre of Malacha Gemura, and since you can't do the Mitzvah without pushing off Shabbos for
the Havara, of caring. Okay, so what's the third answer here from this, right, that he quotes the name of Tosfot? Why, by Mila, don't we set up a decree?
Because you need to do this melacha in order to fulfill the mitzvah.
Right, so Tosfot has this fascinating claim, which is, look, Mila, whether you like it or not, is going to entail Shabbos violation. So once that's the case, like once the Torah told you, go ahead and violate, so then what exactly do we gain, right? Meaning we know that Mila explicitly is Doche Shabbos. It is a malacha by definition. Right? The actual act of Mila is, and therefore once we permit Mila, so there's no room to prohibit Mila for some ancillary concern of a different malacha, right? What do you think about that answer, right? Frame that answer. Explain that answer for me.
Still doesn't explain, though, why it is permitted. Meaning, there's no source, there's no pasuk that says, like, when these two things meet, the mila will arise.
So according to Chazal, there is. Bishmini, afilu bishabbat.
Oh, it says that.
That's a drasha in Shabbos, yes.
So if you combine that with this answer,
right, meaning, right, what is Tosfos getting at? I'm not 100% sure myself, right, but...
Are we sure?
Once you're breaking Shabbos to do with Mila, then, yeah, anything you need to do in order to kill this...
So that is not true, right? That's a machlokas in Shabbos. We don't pasken that way, right? You could have pasken that way, like Rabbi Eliezer, but we don't pasken that way. Rabbi Eliezer thinks that you're allowed to do any malacha in preparation for Mila, right? That's in the perek of Shabbos called Rabbi Eliezer de Mila. Right? What? No, we paskin like the Chachamim against. What? So I don't think Tosfos is saying that you can carry lechatchila. That's Rabbi Eliezer. That's obvious. According to Rabbi Eliezer, there's no question. Right? There's no room to prohibit it because you're allowed to carry. You're allowed to do all the other malachot. So why would you prohibit it? You're allowed to do it, right, ab initio.
Are we sure that the fruit meal itself is actually still in Malachot Shabbos?
Yes.
Like, even though it's
permeable. Yeah, meaning it's a malacha and it's mutter, it's a mitzvah. But it entails an act that in other circumstances would be a malacha. Right, so I'm not really sure what Tosfos wants from this.
Is it only like the, who is it mutter for? Just like the moel, or?
Whoever's doing the milah. Meaning, anyone can be a moel. Right, the main mitzvah is for the father, but anyone can be a moel. Right, so I'm not really sure how to frame this answer in Tosfos. Right, I'm not 100% sure. I mean, it could be that what he's saying is, look, once the Torah tells you that there's a danger and the Torah doesn't care, so then you know that the Torah has actually weighed in on this calculus and said Mila overrides Shabbos, and therefore that sort of guides us to say it's not worth Xera. It could be something like that. It could be that this is another way of saying, look, Mila is really, really important. How do I know? Because it's Docha Shabbos to begin with. I don't really know, right? It's hard to really pinpoint what he wants here. Now the Me'iri, which he quotes, hints at what is already going to be the main answer of the Taz. So who wants to take, actually go to the Me'iri inside. Right, go to the Me'iri inside and then we can look at its summary. Someone take the Me'iri. On the first page, right? Where's the Me'iri from? Remind me his name, where he's from. Menachem. His name is Menachem LeBeit Meir, right? Mishpachat Me'iri, right? Where's he from? Also known as
Provence.
How do you know that he's from Provence? Besides for the fact that I've talked about it 100 times, how do you know? What's the clue?
We're on the.
Very good. That's where all the light names are from. Yes, all of them have nicknames that relate to light. Right? Me'iri, the enlightener. Why? Because what are the two main cities? Where Jews live, at least. Lunel, which means... One of the Orachaims came from it. Not the Orachaim you're thinking of, though. But one of them did, yes. The Provençal one. Right? So, what's the... Right? What are the two main cities that the Jews lived in Provence? Lunel, which means?
What?
The moon? Like lunar? Right? And Narbonne, which means the sun. Right? Now, there are Jews in other places as well. There's some in Montpellier. There's the Ravid, who's like the Gadol of Provence, lives in a different city. Right? He lives in Poschiers. He lives there because, Gavi, you remember why he gets to live in Poschiers and everyone else lives in Lunel-Narbonne? Because he's rich. He's rich and he has a castle, right, or an estate. And so he lives on his estate and it's in Poschiers. Okay, there you go. But which other people live in Provence? Who have light names? Now, Rashi's northern France, and he's, right? Right, whose name is, both his nickname and his actual name are light related. What's the Balamor's name? Zerachia. Reb Zerachia Halevi, right? Zerachia obviously like the sign, the shining of the sun. And the Baal HaMor, why is he called the Baal HaMor? Because he divided his commentary on the Rif into two parts. On some parts of Shas, Nashim Nezikin is known as the Maor HaGadol, and on Moed it's known as the Maor HaKatan, or in English, the sun and the moon, the small luminary and the big luminary, or in French, Lunel and Narbonne, right? Hence, right, they're all very into this. So you have the Sefer HaMeorot, you have, right, you have all types of light obsessions in Provence. Miri is one of them. Miri is a bit later. So what does Miri say? V'yesh mitartzim. Who wants to take the Miri? Good, Yaakov. Shatidche, right? The law is that it should override. So what does Meiri say? The Meiri, the Taz essentially is building on this, even though he doesn't know that. Right? But he's going to say the same thing. The Meiri introduces, and this might be what Tosfos meant, I don't know, but what's the Meiri's thesis? It's a very fascinating thesis. And this is why we have these 2 days of Shiras, to get to this thesis that the Taz introduces, but it appears in this Meiri and maybe in Tosfos. Right? What's the thesis?
Yeah,
Yaakov, you read it. So, yeah, what's the thesis?
That since there is that Mila is different than the other three, because since in the action of Mila you're doing Malacha, therefore, when you can't get rid of Mila by saying you're concerned about doing a different Malacha, because it itself isn't Malacha, so why are we worried about?
Right, so this is similar to Tosfos. Now, the way that Taz is going to take this answer is in a very particular direction. And he's going to say as follows. Right? He's going to say that the rabbis have the authority to prohibit the performance of a mitzvah in a case where their banning of the mitzvah does not explicitly go against a dispensation in the Torah. But if the Torah grants a dispensation directly, the rabbis no longer have the authority to forbid it. Meaning what? Shofar is not a malacha. And therefore, does the Torah ever bother telling you you're allowed to blow shofar? No, because You're allowed to blow shofar on Shabbos, so why would the Torah tell you you're allowed, right? It's not a malacha. So the Torah never bothers telling you explicitly. It's implied, because it's just not usher. And therefore, if the rabbis want to, they can prohibit it. Because they're not going against an explicit statement by God, you're allowed to do this. It's implied, but they're not coming head-to-head with a specific pasuk. But by Mila, where it, as Chazal understand it, it actually entails a malacha. And therefore, God had to come and say, as Chazal understand it, Bishmini afilu bishabbat. So the Torah explicitly said, we know you might think this is usher, but no, I, God, am okay with this. Then the rabbis lose their ability to prohibit. Right? This is the thesis that seems to emerge from the Iri and is explicit in the Taz. And this is, as I said, is what becomes known as the Taz Hayadua, the well-known Taz. Right? Now, it's a very inviting thesis, right? Because what's the claim? Right? What lies behind this claim? Right? It's a, conceptually, it's, it, there's a beauty to it, an elegance to it. Yeah, Rami.
I think why I like it is because it's almost like you sort of have these sections. God's but you have like the Torah, the authoritative command, and then you have what the rabbis are able to work with. When God says something, we have to follow that. But when we have things that are ambiguous, that's what the rabbis say.
Right, meaning what is he saying? He's saying, look, the limit of the rabbi's authority is when God said,
do X
explicitly. And it's a big enough novelty that they're allowed to tell you that not to do X when it's implied that it's mutter in the Torah. But the rabbis, by the very definition of their authority, can't say, God, you said it's okay. We're going to say it's not okay. There's something about that directness, right? Even though, again, by shofar, it's not a malacha. So it's implied that it's mutter because no one ever said it was usher, right? But God didn't explicitly come out and say, do this on Shabbos. He just said, blow the shofar. At least according to the Bavli, right? We did the Yerushalmi, I don't want to get back to it. Now, this is problematic, right? This thesis is problematic. There's something appealing to it, but it's problematic for many reasons, right? Why is it problematic? Yeah?
God's still telling us to do shofar on...
Very good. Right, so one is a conceptual problem, which is if you think that the rabbis are allowed to tell you to not perform a mitzvah when God allowed you to do it, so it's not obvious that it's worse to prohibit a case in which God explicitly said, no, you can, yes, do this, right? That's somehow a greater affront to God than God just didn't even bother saying it was a problem because he had no hava. I mean, it was a problem and you decide it's a problem, right? Conceptually, you have to swallow this thesis that there is, that it's a greater affront to explicitly go against what God said was okay than what God assumed was okay, right? And you don't have to accept that, right? You could just say, look, maybe I wouldn't have known that the rabbis have the right to tell you don't do what God was okay with, or even obligated, right? But once we're willing to swallow that pill, so, okay, there's no difference whether God implied it, whether God said it, right? Their power is much stronger than we might ever have guessed. Right, there is a second set of problems, and this is where, if you want to see everything ever written on this Taz, that's where you can go to Reb David Cohn's book, and I gave you the link. You can look, you can see, is that there are several hundred cases between Rishonim and Achronim and Gemaras where implies that that's not the case, and you have to come up with a Teretz for every single one of them, which is mildly nightmarish. Right, so there are a lot of them. Right.
At least cases where like the rabbis are specifically not the same,
The Torah says that a woman is tmeya after she gives birth, 7 days for a boy, 14 days for a girl, and then any blood that comes out is halachically defined as not tameh, even if it's coming out for 33 or 66 days, and the rabbis come about and say it is tameh, derabanan, right? That's right, the Torah says tahor. It's tahor. It's called, even in Chazal, it's called dam tahor. Right, tahor blood. I remember when I was learning Nida in YU, right? This was the first one I said. I was like, what are you talking about? Right? The Torah said this is not dam nida, it's permitted. It says that. It's a pasuk. It's dam tohar. And rabbinically, we say, no, it's tameh. Right? It's a pasuk.
It's difficult to understand
that
that's a stringency.
Well,
I mean, it's not as difficult to understand.
Correct. So you could defend it. You're right. You could say, oh, they could do it l'chomra when they're not telling you, they're telling you just not to take advantage of a heter, but maybe they can't do it for a mitzvah. Or Vosner on that one says, in an even wilder thesis than the Taz, you know, because you have to get even crazier, and this is why this one sticks in my mind, because Vosner is so wild, like the Taz is wild enough, that Vosner is even like more. Vosner says, no, because the rabbis can't explicitly prohibit something that the Torah permits. But the reason we treat all blood as tameh is because of a minhag that women accepted upon themselves, as the Gemara says. That Rabbi Zera said, B'no Yisrael hechmiru al atzman. And he says, top down, the rabbis are limited. But the hamonam, if the laity choose to have a minhag, they have more power than the rabbis and can actually have a custom which goes against the Torah. Rabbis can't, but your average person on the street, if they decide to have a custom, right, which is... I haven't recovered from that piece in Vosner, and I learned it like 10 years ago. But it's like, it's wild. I think, were Ara and I learning Nida the same year? We might have. I've been angry about it for quite a while, and, you know, it's one of those things that halachic issues in Nida tend to be a common topic in my house because my wife is a yuetzet halacha, so she's learned Nida for many, many years and answers shailas in Nida. So, you know, so like, you know, every so often this actually comes up, right? I get angry every single time, right? It's just such a bizarre position. Rav Vosner, if you don't know, he was a posek in Bnei Brak who died just a few years ago at, I forget how old he was, 104, 112, I don't know. Things were floating around. He was very, 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 very old. He spanned like three centuries, right? He was a tremendous Talmud Chacham, but this is one of the wilder claims that I've ever heard.
Has anyone gone through like all the problems?
Yes, this book that I gave you the link for, Reb David Cohn in Brooklyn. Reb David Cohn just wrote a book called The Taz Hayadua with all the problems and all the proofs for every single possible thing. You know, again, did he miss one? I don't know. There are literally hundreds of examples in that book. It's unreal. He's a very serious Talmud Chacham. He's a very serious person. You know, apparently he has been that way since he was a little kid. You know, I mean, he was.
Taz was his hero. He wasn't gonna let
them. What?
Taz was his hero.
I don't know. Meaning, he was Rav David Cohn. I mean, he's still alive. He's a posek in Flatbush, but he was Rav Lichtenstein's chavrusa back in Chaim Berlin. And Rav Aaron said that he was the person who on Purim would get drunk and then would just start spitting off Tosfos Baal Peh from all over Shas. So apparently he's been this way since he was a little kid, like a teenager. So like, he's a very smart person. So yes, look, people have interesting hang-ups on what they want to write books about. So he wrote a book on the Taz Hayadua, okay? Look, there are all types of interesting books out there. They drive me a little bit crazy sometimes, because whatever, you know? Even if they show tremendous erudition, I'm just like, why? You know, like Otsar HaKippa, it clearly shows tremendous erudition, but it's over 1,000 pages on the Minhag of Kippa. It's like, it's unbelievable, you know? There's also one just on Hagba. Just on Hagba. It's like, I just don't understand. I don't know. It's called, if I remember correctly, it's called like Lahachzir Atara Liyashna Be'inyan Hagbad Hatara Kehilchada. It's like, it's unbelievable what people can write on. Again, it shows tremendous, tremendous knowledge of Torah, but what is going on? It's like certain things I get, they get their own volumes. Like Shmiras Shabbos Kehilchada. I get it. Like, Shabbos is a big topic. It gets... But Rav Shlomo Zalman covered that in like a 2 or 3 volume book, right? But Chol HaMoed Kehilchasa is as long. And so is Yom Tov Sheni Kehilchasa, which is also like 500 pages long. Also, happens to be very good. Yom Tov Sheni Kehilchasa I actually like. But so yes, if you want everything ever written on the Taz, I gave you the link. You can go on Hebrew Book and you can just read. At some point, I did not go through every. I think I read through like the first 90 or something, and I just gave up. Like it was like when I was in Smicha and Ray Schwartz in need, though, when I asked this question. He's like, oh, look at David Cohn's Taz HaYadua.
If you had the opportunity to do a deep dive on any one...
This is not it.
What would it be?
We've already talked about this. If I had to do a deep dive, like if I had to write my dissertation right now, right, it would be on the question of how in the 20th century we replaced the entire conception of minhag, which for thousands of years depended on geography, and replaced it with ethnic identity of your ancestors, right? How that happened, both halachically and historically, right? Because it starts happening in like random little passages in the 500 years ago, and then like, you know, slowly becomes the norm without anyone ever stating it until like the 20th century. Though someone has recently written a master's thesis at Bar Ilan on just the approach of four poskim to this, Rabinovich and Moshe, I think, Shlomo Zalman, something like that. If I had to do a deep dive, I already did my deep dive on halacha and the age of social media. I already did that, right? I already wrote 500 pages on that. You know, eventually, over the beginning of the summer, I started working on it and putting it into a book, and then things just got crazy, and several Rashi Yeshiva said when they have time, they'll review some of it, so, you know. So I already did that deep dive, I don't know. But it's not the task. Okay. Everyone has their thing. If you remember, Yudi was here 2 years ago when Max had an obsession with aliens in Torah. Do you remember this? Yeah. You know, some people really like that. There are two modern articles on that topic. Rabbi Lamb wrote one, and Rabbi Arya Kaplan wrote one. You know. Aliens and halacha, halachically, hashkafically, theologically, fascinating. What? It's fascinating. For, you know, everyone has their things. Look, if any of you write a sefer, even if it's a deep dive into something that I don't think is worth it, you know, if it shows sufficient erudition and analysis, I will make an attempt to get through it, okay? Okay, so that's the claim. So let's look at the Taz, okay? So again, I mentioned a few guys in Seder. Who is the Taz? The Sefer is, he's one of the main commentaries on Shulchan Aruch. Expanded, it is the Turei Zahav, as it says here, right? His name is, let's see if you remember from an hour ago. David, very good. Very good. David Halevi Segal. Right, and again, the reason he's called Segal is because Segal is a traditional Levi name because it stands for Sgan L'Kohanim.
Oh,
right?
That's a Segal?
Segal is Sgan L'Kohanim. It's a Levi name. There are certain Levi names. Levi and Segal. Right? There are probably others.
Well,
and I know, you know, on my block we have neighbors were both Levine. One of them are Kohanim, the others are Yisraelim. Okay, it happens. I don't understand. Okay?
Yeah, I have friends who are Kohanim, who are not Kohanim.
Yeah, it happens. I don't know. But, you know, and then obviously there are Kohen names, like Kohen, Katz, right, which stands for Kohen Zedek, right? Kagan, which is just Yiddish for Kohen, right? And then there's Kasdan, right, which is a more Sephardi one, which is much more in, right, which is much more intense. Right, Kasdan stands for Kohanim Shluchei Derachmana or Didan Ninu, which is a machloket in the Gemara in Kiddushin and Nedarim, whether the Kohanim are our messengers or God's messengers. Right, so it's a machloket. Kohanim Shluchei, or the Kohanim are messengers either of Didan, ours, or Derachmana, of God, Ninhu. So Kasdan is a abbreviation of that phrase, either way you take it. Or Azulai is a Kohen name, right, because it's a long abbreviation for, acronym for, Ishazo Nava Chalala Lo Yikachu, right? The women that are going can't. These are all types of fun ones. But Segal is the Taz's name, right? The Taz is one of the main two commentaries on Shulchan Aruch. He writes on all four Chalakim of Shulchan Aruch, right? Let's see if you remember Gavi. On Orach Chaim, who's the other main commentary? No, that's on Yoredeya. The Shach is the other main commentary on Yoredeya, but on Orach Chaim, it's the Mogen Avram, Avram Gombiner, right? The Shach, the Sifsei Kohen, right? Or Shavtei Kohen Rappaport on Yoredeya, right? Not the Mishneh Berurah, okay? We've said this before, Mishneh Berurah is much later. He's hundreds and hundreds of years later, right? Mogen Avram, Taz are 17th century, like 1600s, right? Mishneh Berurah is 20th century, late 19th, early 20th century. Okay, so So let's look at the Taz. The Taz says, Mishum Shema Yitlenu Biyado Leila Chitzel Baki Lilmod V'Avirenu Dalet Amad Bershut HaRabim. Right, you don't blow shofar on Shabbat because we're worried you'll take the shofar to learn how to blow it for Amot in a public domain. V'hikshah ha-Mizrahi. So, the Mizrahi. Who's the Mizrahi? No, Mizrahi is Rabbi Eliyahu Mizrahi. The Re'im. He has a set of tshuvot. He wrote a commentary, a super commentary on Rashi. B'yom dov namig nigzor shema yitaken kleishir. Why are you worried about... Why don't you say you can't blow shofar ever? Ever. Because you might have to fix it. You might have to make it. You might have to puncture the hole, take out the cartilage, and make it a usable shofar. So carrying on Yom Tov, we're not worried about because you're allowed to carry on Yom Tov. But we're worried. But why don't you just say you're never allowed to blow the shofar? Because you might make a shofar. So he says, V'herich bazel, basov lo teretz klum. He said, the Mizrahi goes through a lot of answers, and lo teretz klum. What's lo teretz klum? He just doesn't... He has no answer. Ulefia ni da'ati. Nire. Okay? In my humble opinion, it seems. And again, I've mentioned this before. Gavi, what does it mean every time someone says ulefia ni da'ati?
That he is trying to be humble, but also expresses.
Exactly. He's about to tell you a chiddush, right? Every time, rabbis have this thing, right? The bigger the chiddush they're about to say, the more humble they couch it in, right? So, Lulefia niyadati is in my humble opinion, meaning I'm about to say something novel, right? And then there's lule de mistafina, which is my favorite, right? Lule de mistafina means if I weren't afraid to say what I'm about to say because everyone disagreed with me, then I would say I'm not saying it. But if I weren't afraid, this is what I would have said, right? That's my, you know, that's, so that's my favorite, but that usually means luli de mistafina means I have a big chiddush, right? Lefiyani daiti means I have a chiddush. Luli de mistafina means I have a really big chiddush, which I'm not saying. I'm just telling you at length what my thing that I'm not saying is, right? And then afterwards they'll usually say something like, you know, but you know, I'm mevatel daati b'fnei hagidolim or something like that. Right, okay, great. Right. Or lule divrehem, right? Something like that would be the same thing, right? If it weren't for the fact that everyone said something else, I would have said this. So he says, lefi ani dati, tikol shofar lo nitan lashir el tkuei shel mitzvah. Al karchach lo gazru kain. Answer one is a very limited answer, which is, look, you blow the shofar, it's not really an instrument. Right? No one uses a shofar as an instrument. They use it for a mitzvah. And therefore, the application of this gzera is so narrow that it's not worth making a gzera. Because, A, it's very narrow, and two, the only real application is a mitzvah. So, you're directly attacking a mitzvah. So, we're not going to do that. Yeah. Good. Yes, potentially. Yes. Lumdishly, there's a lot to what you said, that the Torah defines it as a shir. Right? That doesn't mean it's a... I don't know if this is true. I don't know. Maybe Bill did use shofar as instruments, but this is the Taz's first claim. Yeah, Ezra.
If you're saying that you're not going to do just directly attacking the mitzvah, but
it's directly... So he hasn't said that yet. Here he's just saying it's not worth it, basically, right? The only application of this is the mitzvah, so we're not going to do it. His more radical thesis is what he says after. V'od nira l'taretz, and then he says, De'ein lehem ligzor v'la'akor l'gamrei dar Torah sh'tzivta l'kol b'yom zeh. Answer two is, rabbis only have the ability to tell you to not do a mitzvah sometimes. But they can't uproot the existence of a mitzvah. That is out of their authority. So he says, to tell you not to blow shofar on Shabbos, that's to tell you the mitzvah of shofar exists. It's just don't do it sometimes. To tell you don't blow the shofar ever because we're worried you might make a shofar is to uproot the mitzvah at its core. That you can't do. He says, yeah.
According to that logic, if we were to have one day of Rosh Hashanah, would that mean that we would blow shofar on Shabbos?
Not necessarily, because you could say, I told you not to blow it this year. That doesn't mean I told you never to blow it. I told you this year. He means definitionally. Right, that if you were to tell someone, don't blow the shofar ever, that is uprooting something at its core.
So, did they blew Shabbat Hashanah in the Megiddo? Did they blow in all over your line where they reached the first?
Tomorrow. Tomorrow. Okay. That's where the Gemara calls it Mikdash. The question is, does Mikdash mean Mikdash or Yerushalayim? And is it true? Is it the same for Shofar and Lulav? Right? That's tomorrow. That's a fascinating sugya. You know, that may be what we get to before break. I don't know. But we'll try to finish it up. Okay. But that, I think, is a much broader question in general. How do we define the relationship of the Kedusha of Mikdash and Yerushalayim and things like that? Okay. Lo medakar legamrei. Kevin shebelo shabbat token biyom tov. V'nirish shezeu b'chal mashas yusag l'torah. V'lo lavar al divrei Torah. This is what it means to set up a protective measure around the Torah and not to violate the Torah. Dizehu la'avor al divrei Torah la'akor legamrei. Right? You can't say that that's protecting the Torah because... what's the Taz's argument? Right? He says you can't uproot something in its entirety because then you can't plausibly fit it in the relevant category that gave you rabbinic authority to begin with, which is you have the right to protect the Torah. You can't plausibly say you're protecting the Torah when... Right, you're totally uprooting. To say sometimes don't do it, that's a balancing act. But to get rid of it, that goes beyond rabbinic authority, and therefore you can't do it. And he says that's why Mila is different. The Ran, he doesn't like his answers. And now, I'm not sure if the Taz thinks this is a third answer or this is how he understands his second answer, right? But here's where he introduces the explicit question, right? The first one is you can't get rid of a mitzvah entirely, and now he has this different formulation, which is da Torah ripta beferush of a yom hashmini. By Mila, the Torah says do it on Shabbos. Afil b'Shabbos lo ratzu l'akor dvar Torah beferush mishum gzeira. Because when the Torah says explicitly you can't, you're allowed to do it, the Torah can't, the rabbis can't tell you not to do it. So here you have two formulations. One is you can't get rid of a mitzvah in its entirety, and the other is you can't go against an explicit permission. One of those formulations I get, right? The first one, okay, I'm willing to buy. You can't get rid of a mitzvah in its entirety, you can do it sometimes. But the Taz seems to equate that with 2b. Right, which I would have said is a different answer, but he seems to equate it, which is what emerged from the Iri, is that you can't set up a gzera that goes against an explicit heter in the Torah, right? Because again, that's beyond rabbinic authority. Now the Taz says this in multiple places, as he himself notes that he says in Yerodei Yaakov Yodayin as well. I gave you one; I had some mercy. This is not a given at all, Gavi. You can tell them it's not a given. I have mercy. I'm trying really hard to have mercy here. Rav Rosenzweig used to say about his shir that the hardest part of his shir was the tzimtzum, right? Was with restraining himself, which I always found astonishing because, like, in an entire year in Rosenzweig's shir, you can do like 5 blot, right? Like because he goes so exhaustive on every sugya. So I never quite knew what you could add to the sugya, but I feel that way even though I don't cover what. Yeah. When I was in a shir in NYU, right? Meaning he has this thing of just going, as deep as you can into a sugya. Oh, Ariel. Moshe Ariel. Yeah, Ariel's great. Rabbi Ariel. He's great. Yeah, meaning Ariel's a few years older than me. Yeah, Ariel is 2 or 3 years old. Maybe more, I don't even know. Trying to think. I think there's 2 kids. The one that overlapped with me in yeshiva was Itamar, right? Who's a year younger than me, but he skipped a grade. But we were the ones who overlapped. He gives a share in YU, and he's a dayan on the Besna of America. But Ariel was like a few years older than me. He was still at the end of, I think, his time in shir when I started. It's all mishpacha in Rambam, right? Because he's Ariel's nephew.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So that's the Taz. And like I said, this is a very far-reaching thesis. I'm not sure it's right. I don't know. Right? Both because of the reason Yonatan said before, which is, again, his second answer, which, again, he equates with the third answer. I'm not sure it's the same. I get. To say you can't get rid of a mitzvah, you can tell you not to do it temporarily, I sort of get the logic. To say that the Torah said you can do it, rather than implied you can do it, and that makes all the difference, That, again, as I said, David Cohen goes through all of them. If you know, there are textual proofs, there's conceptual problems with it. I don't know what to do. Okay. Yeah. So now, in the time we have remaining, we've now seen the Taz's thesis. You now know it. And as I said, what you need to know is that it's A, very well known, B, extremely problematic. That's all you need to know, okay? That it's quoted all the time, but it's not at all obvious that it's right. Okay? Yeah, his first answer, I think, is much stronger, but it's this last answer that people like the most, and is the one that Taz himself quotes in other places. I don't know, because the Taz seemed to have liked his last formulation best, because he quotes it in more than one place. I don't know. Where everyone likes quoting it and then saying, this might or might not be true, but it's the Taz, the famous Taz. Okay. I don't know what to tell you. We don't often poskim like the Taz, just know that, right? Like, in general, poskim, if it's a machloget Magen Avram and Taz and Arachaim, they'll follow the Magen Avram. If it's a machloget Shach and Taz and Yardea, they'll follow the Shach. That's just the way it is. We do sometimes follow the Taz. It's not clear why. Right? Apparently Rabbi Soloveitchik once said that the reason we don't follow the Taz is because when the Shach wrote his commentary on Shulchan Aruch, he was finishing his commentary and he wanted a haskama, so he sent it to the Taz, because the Taz is a little bit older than the Shach, and the Shach was intimidated by how good the Shach was. So refused to give him haskama, and therefore Hashkacha has made it that in revenge we never paskin like the Taz. I don't know what to make of this story. This is what I heard when I was in YU. I have no idea what to tell you.
Have you heard the story about the Taz talking about like Tatras and
being
that's familiar?
I don't know. Right. And the Taz's father-in-law is who? Because he quotes him all the time and argues all the time. It's the tensest relationship in that family ever. And he'll always quote him as Mem Vav Chet, right? Which is Mori V'chatni, my father, my master, my father-in-law, right? Is the Bach, right? Is Rav Yoel Sirkis, the comment during the tour, right? Yeah, that's the, right, the apocryphal story, which I don't know whether it's true or not, is that when he proposed whatever, proposed to, yeah. So apparently, as the story goes, the way it happened was that the Bach was giving a shir, and he came across a pasuk, and somewhere in Navi, like Yechezkel or something, and you know, rabbis traditionally aren't so great at Tanakh, but his daughter was an expert in Tanakh, so he called in his daughter to weigh in on the pasuk, and he was so happy that she got it and she knew exactly where it was from that he started, you know, singing his daughter's praises. Oh, you're brilliant, you're as radiant as the Levana, or as radiant as the moon. And the Taz said to the Bach, can I be Mekadesh the Levana? That's the apocryphal story as it goes. I don't know, right? I have no idea. When I was in Poland on the Poland trip, in Shana Aleph, that was the story they tell at the Taz's grave. Okay, like I don't know if it's true. I wasn't there.
Why do we take the rabbin who say something into account when discussing their ideas?
What do you mean?
There are times when we discount or give more.
Reason. Oh, because Torah, because Psak is a balance of three things, essentially. Independent analysis of canonical sources, right? Meaning, how do you understand whatever you count as the canon? Let's say Chazal, right? Let's say. But even that's not clear, right? Meaning, it really means Bavli, but it doesn't mean Yerushalmi, doesn't mean Breitza, doesn't mean Midrash, doesn't mean Agadic text within the Bavli, doesn't only mean Halachic text. Complicated question, but whatever you count as canon for these purposes. The second is authority, right? And the third is custom, is Minog. Right, all three sort of work together, and it's a balancing act when you paskin. But authority is clearly one of them. Right? It just is. We can talk about why that is, but it is. Okay, the Meiri gives another answer, and that was going back to what I, pushed aside before. But the Meiri actually suggests this, which is maybe that we actually do make our din paskin like Rabbi Eliezer, right? Namely, that maybe we paskin like Rabbi Eliezer that at least on a biblical level, it's permitted to carry for Mila, and therefore we're not going to prohibit it rabbinically because you're allowed to carry, right, on a biblical level. Rabbinically you can't, but we're not going to set up a gzera like gzera. Right? So if you look at the last line here in the Meiri, he says, Va'od shari min haTorah af machshirei mila dochen et haShabbat ela shechachamim asur bekach. Right, answer two is maybe mila, it's really permitted even to carry in all the preparatory stuff. So why would I prohibit it? Because you might violate Shabbos. It's going to be pretty hard to violate Shabbos because you're allowed to violate Shabbos. So,
why? You said that that's just a regular,
right, meaning we don't paskin that way, but the way the Meiri understands it is that we paskin that way on a biblical level. We just don't paskin that rabbinically.
Why rabbinically,
we tell you, you know, make sure you get everything there before Shabbos. Bring the baby, bring the water, bring the knife, bring the whatever. Yeah, it's a good question. But this is Meiri's claim, right? Is that we fundamentally passing the Rabbi Eliezer. Now the third answer in the Taz, right? The Yesh Mitartzim Shalula Veshofar Megillah Lo Nemar Alem Beferish Shivnasin Veshabbat. Right. The third answer is very explicitly the Taz. The difference is, does the Torah say explicitly do it, or does it just imply it? If it says explicitly do it, so then you're allowed to do it. If not, not. Right? He says there it's just implicit. By shofar, it's implicit that you are allowed to blow shofar on Shabbos biblically because it's not a malacha. But the Torah doesn't say you're allowed to blow on Shabbos, it just says, it never says you can't. As opposed to mila, where it says you can. Once it says you can, the rabbis can't pull that authority away. What? I didn't take issue. I'm just telling you, the Meiri says it as well. Okay. So let's summarize what we've seen, and you know, whatever answers we get through. Okay? So again, the question that we've been dealing with, and as I said, this is somewhat a meta question, which is the nature of rabbinic legislation, is why do rabbis, right, tell you don't blow shofar on Shabbos, don't take the lulav on Shabbos, and then other things they let it go, like mila. And as we said, some of these answers just seem to go along the axes we suggested yesterday. Right, that the cost is too high to prohibit mila. That was the first answer in Tosfos. Mila is just super important. The second answer was along the axis of how likely it is that it will lead to a problem. Right, so Tosfos said, well, mo'alim are less likely to make a mistake than the average person on the street. So the risk isn't so high, so it's worth, right, it's worth making a gzera. The third is to say, look, it's not in their authority to do this. Why? So one answer in Tosfos was because, look, the Torah already said you're allowed to do Chavallah. So once you're allowed to do Chavallah, who are we to weigh in and tell you you can't do it because you might perform a different Malacha? This is clearly strong enough to override Malacha. Then you have different answers in the Taz. You can't uproot a mitzvah in its entirety. What's the logic behind that? Because what gives rabbis their authority is to protect the Torah. But once they're uprooting a mitzvah in its authority, in its entirety, it's hard to say that's protection rather than an attack. Right, then you have the Meiri's last answer and the Taz's famous answer, which is, it's a difference between when the Torah implies that it's mutter and says explicitly it's mutter. Right? I mean, there's another problem with the Meiri, which is the problem that Yudi said, is the Torah doesn't actually say you're allowed to do mila on Shabbos. Chazal have a drasha on the word bashmini, that it means a field of Shabbos, and he takes that as explicit enough. Right?
What is the status of that drasha? Is that a
mutter? No, I mean, it sounds like a real drasha, but it's, you know, it's not like explicit, right? Bishmini could have just meant on the eighth day, rather than on the eighth day, even if it falls on Shabbos, right? It's not explicit. It's subject to drasha. So it's also a little bit weird in that sense. And again, the fundamental problem is I think, the conceptual problem that Yonatan raised, which is why, right? Meaning, at the end of the day, the Torah says, I get his second answer, that there's a difference between saying don't do the mitzvah sometimes and don't do it ever. That I get. Right? Because then that's the difference between protecting the Torah and attacking the Torah. But this answer of there's a difference between when the Torah says explicitly you can do it and when it doesn't tell you you can't do it because whoever thought it was usher, right? I don't really know why that holds water. Meaning, you would think that if God, it didn't even enter God's mind, so to speak, that it would be usher, that would be good enough reason to say it shouldn't enter your mind either, right? The Meiri and the Taz just say, nah, if God implied that it was mutter because there's no reason for it to be usher, so then you can prohibit it. But if he had to tell you it was mutter, so then you can't do it. I don't know. Right, the other answer of the Taz was, look, you only ever blow the shofar for a mitzvah, so it's not the type of thing we make gzera about. We only make gzera about things that are also not mitzvahs. Okay? I don't know. Now, there's a few other answers. So if you look here at the summary, So he quotes the Meiri, we saw it. Then there's the suffix answer of the Ritva, if you remember, right? And here in this Otsa Rishon, they go through it, right? Alter Zanal Shamila Lekasfik Aklal, right? They go through all the suffix questions, which the Acharim don't love. Correct. It's just is there a petach because it is a suffix. Again, the Achronim really don't like this answer because they say there are cases of suffix. Right, there are suffix cases. So, for example, like a baby who might be a nafel, right? A baby who might not survive. You don't give him a mila, right, until you know he's going to survive. Right, there are cases of doubt where you don't perform mila, right? Or ben hashmashot. Right, if he's born ben hashmashot Friday evening, going into Shabbos, you wait till Sunday, right? Because you're only allowed to do mila bismana on Shabbos and not mila shlo bismana. So if it's Friday ben hashmashot, it might have been born Friday, so then you can't do the mila on Shabbos because it would be a day late. But you can't do the mila on Friday because it might be a day early. You're never allowed to do mila early, so you end up doing it on Sunday.
I guess I have a question on that case. Like,
yeah.
You have a rogue like mohel who like decides that so like you have a baby born in Banish Machos on Friday then you have the mohel decides to do the bris like at exactly that time the next Friday baby Banish Machos, is that kosher?
I mean, what do you mean kosher?
Like
it's kosher post facto, it's kosher, it's a mila, but it's usher.
Wait, why can't you do it in Banish Machos?
Because
if it's part of the previous day, if Banish Mashot is part of the
very good. So, so there's two answers I could give to that question. One is a practical answer, which is, you know, you don't know exactly what time in Banish Mashot tends towards day and which one tends towards night, right? So it could be that you'll end up doing it, you know, that it was born at the time that tended towards day, and now the Banish Mashot is tending towards night. That's the very practical answer. The more conceptual answer is that many of the Acharonim, and this is implied in certain Rishonim, like the Ritva as well, is that Ben HaShmashot is not a normal suffix. Right? It's in the very extreme language that the Acharonim really like using is Klape Shmaya Galia Suffiku. That even for God it's a doubt. Meaning it's definitional. It's definitional. It's a chalot doubt. It's not that it's we don't know. It's that it is, by its very definition, a doubtful time that shares properties of day and property of night. And therefore, you always have to treat it with the stringencies of both by definition. It's a ritva, so I can't, like, it does have quite a, it has quite a good pedigree, but it's, yeah.
So it's not that all of Banish Mashot is part of the day and Banish, or all of Banish Mashot.
Correct.
It's that some part of it is part of day, part of
no, so it's either part of it is day, part of it is night, or the Ritva's claim is that no, all of it is
both.
Is both. Yes, it's a middle zone. It's a time which is neither day nor night, or both day and night. I don't know, whatever you want to call it.
Every day is the
Yom HaRoi. Well, is after sunset at some point before nightfall at some point. Yeah, but the exact parameters there are complicated because the Gemara, right, has a machloket about it. It could be as long as 72 minutes, or maybe even more, or it could be Rabbi Yossi in the Gemara says that Ben HaShmashot Kerif Ayin, right, that it's as long as a blink, right? There's a moment, and we just don't know exactly when it is, but it's at some point, it's this magic moment. So, okay. Let's see. Okay, you know what? Most of the rest of the answers that he deals with are really fleshing out some of this, this question of Safek and Sveik of the Yoma and things like that. But we've basically seen all the main answers in Rishonim and Achronim, like five or six answers. I lost count of how many we said. But as you see, right, it's not just that this is like a local question, right? For most of the Rishonim and Achronim who weigh in on this, right, this is an avenue for them to really attack fundamental questions in the nature of rabbinic legislation. Right, and you know, that's what I said. Like, yes, this is sort of a continuation of the sugya we were doing before. Right, obviously we're discussing it because we were dealing with blowing the shofar on Shabbos, but the questions that they're dealing with are much more universal. Right, and it cuts to the very heart of the nature of rabbinic law. Okay, so let's, I think, stop there. Tomorrow, what I want